welcome to this episode of Better Off Read. This is episode 123. Thank you for listening. So this is a... So I re-recorded this talk that I did in Brisbane for the Brisbane Writers Festival. So thank you to Brisbane Writers Festival for giving me some money to stop and spend some time thinking about the amazing work of Janet Frame and sort of how it affected my life. I really enjoyed writing this talk. This talk will seem a bit odd because I decided to record it exactly as I had presented it on the day. So it has it refers to things that were happening then, and it refers to me being on that land and not here and all sorts of things. There's a shout out to Laura G. McKay, who was going to co-host the talk with me, but was unable to. So yeah, there's all sorts of like weird things like that. I'm very grateful again to have got to write about Janet Frame, a huge, massive influence on me. And I know that there was a lot of discomfort and anger about the way this talk was framed and the words that were used around it to advertise it. And I guess that's one of the big reasons I wanted to put the talk in the public, because I think, it felt strange that it was taking place in Australia, where people who look after the memory of Janet Frame and who know Janet Frame were unable to see it. So I just wanted to put it out there. Very open to any criticism. I think I say in the talk, this isn't meant to be any kind of definitive, objective truth about any of the things that I talk about. They are simply things that are rattling around in my own mind, problematic mind. Like I say, you can always get hold of me here. You can always get hold of me on Twitter. My DMs are open, as they say. But yeah, anything anyone like to talk about, let me know. There's always space on the podcast for a right of reply as well. Like we can, I could interview you and we could talk about it. But anyway, thank you so much. And I hope you enjoy this. We will be back later in January with the series that we started before Christmas, before I started doing this. We'll be back with Beyond a Joke, and we'll be talking to some cool people about things they find funny. So yeah, thank you so much for listening. Oh, and just I preface this in the talk, but there is a little bit of talk about alcohol and drug addiction and suicidal ideation. So yeah, if you are perhaps just choose when you listen to this. There's another warning comes up in the talk, and yeah, please feel free to push the stop button. That's what it's there for. Yay, stop buttons. Okay, thank you so much. I get very anxious when I'm doing something like this. I know it can make for a rather unpleasant audience experience, so I like to start thinking about the land, the unimaginable time it has been here, the way it holds us now, and the way it will carry on. I'd like to acknowledge the traditional owners and elders of the Aboriginal nations of this land. And this brings me to voice a hope for tēnā rangatiratanga, the return of the stolen land I live on in Aotearoa to its rightful owners. This thought brings me to my belief in my impermanent nature, the illusion of self and the ever-presence of all times. And I guess gives me a chance to welcome the memory of Janet Frame into the room, so that we remember that she was a complete person with family and friends and a life well outside this talk I'm giving today. One of my aims in this talk is to maximise her memory beyond the myth, and so I want to remember all of her. This is one of my favourite pictures of Janet Frame. I love her frock. And also, this is a photo taken when she was 52 years old, and I am 52 years old, so I like that. I like the photo for that as well. I want to send best wishes to Laura Jean McKay. Laura Jean and I have had so much fun talking about her session and this one, and I feel sad she can't be here, but also grateful for the conversations we've had over the years and will continue to have. It is always a pleasure to be in the company of her amazing mind and work. My name is Pip Adam. My land and waters are in the Jalisco region of Mexico. My family is also Romani, so has found precarious home in many places around Europe. I also have family from Scotland. I come to you today as a writer, but perhaps also more importantly as a reader. A friend said to me the other day that writing is an overflow of reading, and I quite like that. I have published 4 books. The last, a novel called Nothing to See, was published here in Australia by Gerimondo, and I just want to say a huge thank you to them for that. This is a photo of my friend William Brandt and Kerry Fox from the 1990 film An Angel at My Table, which was directed by Jane Campion and based on Janet Frame's trilogy of autobiographies published during 1982 and 84 when Frame was 56 and 58. This trilogy is To the Island, An Angel at My Table, The Envoy from the Mirror City. William and I worked for about 7 years writing poetry, prose, and non-fiction with people who live in prisons. During this time, I did not see An Angel at My Table. I hadn't seen An Angel at My Table since it came out in 1990. William plays Bernard, an American poet who becomes Janet Frame's lover while she is living and writing in Ibiza, Spain, during a sojourn in the Mediterranean region in 1956 to 1957. Over the years I have known William, people have often made jokes that I didn't fully understand about William and Janet Frame, William and Kerry Fox. Quite a few times people have said to him something like, you know, that time just after walking, it's when I'm at my most creative. And he would laugh and they would laugh and I would be a bit confused and smile. It turns out, on watching this movie again, that this is what Bernard says after interrupting a makeout session to read a poem he's written. Now, I'm not mentioning William to demonstrate how small New Zealand is, or to name drop, so you think I'm well connected. I'm really interested in the bleed of this imagined version of Frame's life into the real world. It also helps me remember that every imagining of a real life comes out of another person's lived experience and is, if you'll excuse the pun, framed by this. For instance, in Campion's version of Frame's life, Frame doesn't meet Bernard until 70% of the way through the film. I accidentally had them meet much sooner. I also want to credit Fiti Hiriaka, who pointed out a good explanation of what I'm trying to talk about here is Kim Kardashian wearing Marilyn Monroe's dress to the Met Gala. I think if we can think of biographers inside the lives of writers in the same way we think of Kardashian inside Monroe's dress, we have a pretty awesome metaphor for the point I'm trying to make. Thanks, Fiti Hiriaka. Because of this idea that I'm playing with, the idea of the impossibility of separating the biographer from the biography, in this first part of the session today, I think it's only right that I disclose a little bit about myself. This in the hope that you will be able to see that what I am talking about is my version of Janet Frame's work and life, and not some objective truth about her or robust analytical criticism of her work. I want to make explicit some of the lived experience behind the conclusions I've drawn about Frame's life, and how these experiences have drawn me to her work, and perhaps made me wary of some of the myth that sort of shrinks this life into something that which I think never fully recognises the genius and joy that was also in Frame's life. This means that I'll be speaking a bit about some tough things that I might sort of brush off during this talk. I'm very happy for people to leave or stop listening as they need to, and also I want you to know that I'm not talking about any of these things for the first time here. I've had a great deal of help over the years and have a great deal of help now to develop workable boundaries about what I share about myself and what I don't. So let me tell you how my mistake skewed my view of Janet Frame's life and made me always want to challenge some of the dominant ideas about her. In 1994, I spent time in a psychiatric ward in Hamner, North Canterbury, for the treatment of alcohol and drug addiction. I'd been clean and sober for about 3 months before I got to the hospital, but had become suicidal in the face of surfacing memories that I thought I had successfully sunk in a lot of booze and opioids. I'd always wanted to be a writer, but when I hit my rock bottom and realised stopping drinking and using was a matter of life and death, I decided to stop writing, as I thought it would be impossible to write without drinking. This sounds sad, but I was pretty fine with this decision. The seriousness of my situation was stark to me, and I was willing to make any sacrifice because, although suicidal, I really did not want to die. When I left the hospital and returned to the real world, I started thinking about FRAME. The predominant story that is told about FRAME in New Zealand centres on the 8 years she spent at Seacliff Hospital near Dunedin, wrongfully diagnosed with schizophrenia, and how a brutal operation was cancelled at the last minute because she won the Hubert Church Award for her first book of fiction. I think, sadly, and I hope I'm wrong, that before her novels, before her poetry or her essays, this is what people in New Zealand know about FRAME. I'd started writing a little bit of poetry while I was in hospital, and so was feeling quite aligned with FRAME. In a stalkerish and quite paranoid way, I had started collecting things FRAME and I had in common to draw some cosmic threads between me and her. Didn't we both have dental nurses for mothers? Weren't we both 5'4"? Partly this was in the hope of writing again, but I think, possibly, mainly, to draw myself as a tragic literary figure. Poor Janet, I would think, poor me. So I went to the library to get out FRAME's autobiography. I had vague memories of Campion's film. I'd read Faces in the Water and Owls Do Cry. I kind of knew what I was in for, and I sort of liked the idea that I could perhaps find a model for myself as sad and misunderstood. When I got to the library, I took out the autobiography. I was sure there was only one and took it home to read. What I had taken home was The Envoy of the Mirror City. And what I read was quite confusing to my image of FRAME. Here was FRAME in London with other writers. Here were the later works of FRAME. Here was FRAME in Ibiza with Bernard. Here was FRAME writing, like for real, for work. I really need to stop at this point and make sure that I am clear that I am not discounting the pain and hardship that FRAME suffered. That is not my intention, but what I found in Envoy and in her later work was this incredible hope. Instead of the figure I had known, who really seemed to still be in Seacliff as we told this story over and over again, I found a writer who had found a way to write and stay alive, had found a way to make the world work for her. Here was, after all, a working class person who had found a way to be a writer. And here I want to complicate a bit what we might think of as FRAME's upbringing. FRAME's mother was a poet. She sold poems door to door during the Depression. It was a home of origin that valued literature. I think this, like other facts about FRAME's life, doesn't fit easily with some of the myth around her. What I find tricky and frustrating is the way maybe we, New Zealand, is not ready to let FRAME continue past the myth of the genius in Seacliff, saved at the last minute by the recognition of the literary community. Almost like the canon had saved her and in saving her would not let anyone forget it. Why do we hold so strongly to these myths? Why do we emphasise some parts of an artist's stories and not others? Why are some artists known far more for their lives rather than their work? There is something of the desire to keep artists separate, mystical, that they maybe speak from outside of the community. Maybe they are something akin to spiritual leaders. They can see things about society that we can't. I have a theory this is because, like other things that are kept outside the economy model, housework, caring for family, we don't want to feel guilty about not paying artists properly for their work. It becomes a higher calling, or worse, a labour of love. But I think there's also something more sinister and entrenched in this view of the artist as outsider in a different plane of reality. It's centred in this word unworldly, a word that suggests to me that different ways of thinking or feeling or sensing makes us not of this world, therefore out of the auspices of any care or responsibility. One of the things that struck me so hard about watching Angel this time was the way FRAME is set apart from the other patients at Seacliff. This terrifying idea that difference is fine as long as it comes with genius. That it's okay to change ideas, diagnoses, the way we do things to accommodate genius, but really, predominantly, we need to maintain the neurotypical status quo that creates systems that make it so hard for some people to find success or even comfort. Those in power demand a certain degree of same to accommodate any degree of different. Again, I don't want to suggest that in her real life many accommodations were made for frame. I think it was fucking tough, which makes her work all the more incredible, but I do think this desire to make people fit into the stories that seem to be reinforced over and over. This is polite. Bodies should climb stairs. Children should read. Gender is binary. Give me some insight into why we have inherited this shorthand for frame's life. Despite her writing three books about her life, an incredible self-determining job, we still want to fit her into this mould of the hospital, the genius, the last-minute reprieve. Not, I'd suggest, because of any mythical impulse of a desire to celebrate her in this particular way, but as part of the process of continuing down the same path. In her introduction to An Angel at My Table, the collected autobiographies, I would have never made the mistake that I made if this collected sort of collection of them had existed that first time I visited the library. Campion recalls visiting Frame's house. She has some things to say about the cleanliness of the house and also the ways the rooms in the house are set up. What seems completely missed in this description of Frame at home is that the home is a workplace, that Frame is a working writer, and the predominant story of Frame, even the way we bandy around the word genius, seems to take some of that hard work away from her. And in doing it to Frame, it also means we can do it to other artists. Art in this way becomes a calling. We get to ignore the massive ways we make it impossible for some people to write, and the fact that once the calling has been heeded, the book written, it enters into an extremely commercial landscape. It becomes product and supports many people's paid work. Despite being a story from the dusty past of New Zealand, I think it highlights some of the ways we talk about writers even today. I continued to follow in Frame's footsteps after my unhealthy obsession with her calmed. I went to Otago University. While there, I fell in love with one of my lecturers and experienced a rather nasty breakdown as a result. I also kept writing, and my first collection of short stories won the Hubert Church Award. As a result of winning this award, I was interviewed for The Listener, and the reviewer, after lobbing a couple of easy questions my way, asked, "This book talks a lot about drugs and alcohol and sex work, and what is your experience with these things?" In a split second, I got a flash of what my life could be. I suddenly realised what a better story I was if I answered yes and gave some gruelling details. How that was a story that fitted something of the genre we call a writer's life. I also think, at this moment, there was something of a commercial thought in my brain. I really wanted to write, and to write I needed to sell books. And I started to think about maybe I would be more bankable as an addict turned writer than just a writer. But then I thought of my parents, the embarrassment they felt over the publication of the book, the way they recognised features of our private lives and assumed others would see that too. And I said, I don't really talk about that. Of course, I'd never been asked, so it was a reply that kind of shows the overblown idea I had of myself. I am incredibly grateful to the reporter who said, "That's fine. My job is to ask the questions, and your job is to reply in a way you can live with." I took that sentence with me everywhere I went after that. It continues to be helpful anytime I'm asked to speak in public, and it is often the one piece of advice I give to writers who have first books coming out. That split second that I had expanded to a big to-and-fro conversation in my head. I think it did come from having seen what had happened to Frame, but I think also it came from growing up in the 80s. I had seen Anna Nicole Smith. I had seen Britney Spears. I understood how quickly these stories got away out of the control of the person they belonged to. How the real person often becomes suppressed by other people's stories of the person. And I think this is one of the exciting things about this moment to me. I'm really buoyed by the way artists are able to take control of their public selves using social media. Now, I realise this is hard work and is not paid for and demands a lot, but also not a lot of the media work with work that predates it is paid for either. And yeah, I get excited that artists are able to take control of how they portray themselves, and it gives me a lot of hope. The reaction to my first book, a work written close to autobiography and presented in realist terms through me, still throws me. It's an odd experience to write your view, your experience, and have people talk about it. There was a bit of a kerfuffle when my book won the award. More than one person said publicly that it didn't deserve to win. It had received universally bad reviews. People did not like the lack of resolution. People found my writing unlyrical and stilted. They found the obsessive eye to action annoying. It was quite funny in a lot of ways because a lot of the things people found hard about my writing are things that people find hard about me as a person. Truth be told, I felt kind of devastated by their reaction. I had hoped to bring something into the world which made it better. I thought I had written hopeful stories, experimented with different modes of expression to try and bring to light experiences that hadn't always been represented in literature. But it appeared I had created something that made people annoyed at best and really sad or disgusted at worst. Only Disconnect, one review was titled, and a few more people lined up to talk about the distance, the emotional deficiencies of the story. There was a real temptation to change, to take heed of what was being said and try to write like a proper writer. My mum said to me one night, "What you want to do is write a book that people want to read." She was correct, of course, and I tried, but I just didn't seem to have the skills. My brain is made for patterns and structure. I am always interested in how things fit together, or the shape of letters, or how words sound together. All the sort of machinery parts of writing. Sure, I'm interested in the characters in the story, but really only to the extent that I can use them to work out the way people act in the real world. People confuse me, and mainly my work has people in it so that I can put into action the things I see taking place in the world around me, to sort of slow it down so I can get some kind of handle on what is making the population tick. I imagine none of this is of interest to other people and largely not what people are reading for. It was Frame I looked to during this time. Not her life this time, but her work. I read her short story, The Reservoir, over and over and over. A deceivingly conversational story that is painstakingly crafted so that although it mimics the diversions and side paths of a child telling a story, not a word is wasted. A highly structured story about a structure. A story about a pandemic. Hiding over and over again what it is about. Coming at its horrifying truth but offering the oddest and most unsatisfying of endings that agitates instead of calming. If an ending is to bring a plane into landing, in the reservoir, Frame shifts the runway by inches every second and the plane descends long after you read the last lines. The last lines are, "Well, we were not afraid of it. Oh no, it was only the reservoir. It was nothing to be afraid of. It was just a flat reservoir with a fence around it and trees and on the far side a little house with wheels inside and nothing to be afraid of." What I think kept me coming back to this story and swans and prizes and the others was this awareness that there was another direction to take my work in. Instead of back to the path, I could lean into the discomfort, the strangeness. I saw in Frame's descriptions a way to lean into the things that had been said as shortcomings and create something else. What I found in her work was not fantasy, though it was an intense realism, a hyperrealism, something so closely observed that it made everything we took for granted strange. I recognised and realised I had been inspired by the listing. Writing is not meant to try to simulate reality. It is not supposed to include all of reality. So the strategy, instead of tying the story more tightly to the real world, kind of wound the contrast up and made it as unbearable as an acid trip. Cracks appear in the earth. The grass was bled yellow. The ground was littered with beetle shells and snail shells. Flies came in from the unofficial rubbish dump. At the back of the house, the twisted flypaper hung from the ceiling. A frantic buzzing filled the room as the flypapers became crowded. Even the cat put out her tiny tongue, panting in the heat. And then the way she goes close with words and makes them strange. Keep your sun hats on, our mother called. All right, we knew. Sunstroke when the sun clipped you over the back of the head, striking you flat on the ground. Sunstroke, lightning, even tidal waves were threatening us on the southern coast. The world was full of alarm. Her writing has always felt more like the world to me, and I realized that now everyone was angry at me. Why not lean into this way? Instead of trying to calm down the tricky things about me and the way I was in the world, why not emphasize them? If everyone was displeased, why not write for myself? Not to communicate in any great way, but to build these small diorama to maybe help me get a handle on my view of the world. So much of my life was vigilance in the face of the shared reality, which I understand intellectually, but takes massive effort to conform to. Why not have these small engines for myself? This place that feels like my world and is peopled with folk in controlled ways that give me the space and time to understand and function. It's frame I continue to turn to in order to keep the faith. Stay the path. Not because I consider myself anywhere near her, but because her work offers a path, an assurance, a model. When I began my novel, The New Animals, all I really wanted to write was this idea I had for a human evolving into a sea creature. And I wrote, trying to seamlessly fit together this science fictional plane into a book about hairdressing. Then my friend Carl Shuker suggested I read Frame's Intensive Care. And if I could be so bold, I am suggesting, if you haven't already, that you read it as well. This novel is astounding. Although in three parts, it is really about two times, one long after the other. So little holds these two parts together, a pear tree perhaps. But I argue the story, the plot, the book is not in the black marks on the white page, but in the space between the dramatic and sudden shift from the first timeline of the book to the second. Some amazing headwork takes place in the relation of one story next to the other. The tale of the past we know and understand and the prophecy of a future civilization that eliminates the substandard and abnormal human. There's something in this leap, but in the way both stories become, they are in the same book, leak into each other. So the reading experience is often one of reconstituting, reevaluating, rewriting the book as you go. Instead of creating a simple this in the past equals this in the future matrix, Frame creates a book where fitting things together is just out of reach, so close and yet so far. Frame's final, in inverted commas, novel, The Carpathians, was the touchstone for my last book, Nothing to See. This book is so cunning. I must admit that reading it wasn't always good for keeping the faith. Time and again, Frame would write the most incredible, profound sentences. Sentences, I felt, made proclamations that were as big as the one I was using as a basis for my whole book. And then she would place them and walk away because she always had another huge and incredible observation. The book, I think, is so good because of the way it perfects this overlaying effect between the real, the hyperreal, and the imagined. It isn't a normal world where weird things happen, nor is it an unknown world with resonances of our world. Instead, it is this astounding experience of reading all these ways of being in the world, overlapping all at once. As I read this novel, they come in waves, and the feeling is not disconcerting, even though it is haunting. Instead, it feels a lot like settling in. It feels more real to me than any Carver. In a lot of ways, the way Frame's work feels real to me makes those works of social realism seem like fantasy. And so, where does this leave us? I think for me, researching this talk, it has sort of repositioned Frame for me. People often introduced her to me as a social realist, and this was the position I think a lot of people read her. And I think, yes, this is realism, but not as we have been taught to recognize it. I was really helped in my thinking by the work of Andrew Dean, especially in his book Metafiction and the Postwar Novel. In a way, he reintroduced Frame to me as a postmodernist. He recognises the experimentation that is taking place, and he also makes incredibly interesting propositions about the way Frame wrote to try and control reader response using metafictional interventions. I am not good at conclusions, but I guess what my hope is that we can have a chance to meet Janet Frame again, anew, to move her on from Seacliff and recognise the work she did and how thrilling it can be to read. I feel like this is the perfect time to read the novels of Janet Frame, like somehow we as readers have caught up with her work. As I was reading these later novels, I was thinking a lot about Laura Jean's amazing book and also about the Daniels new film, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. I feel like we have an amazing opportunity to meet Frame's work in the context of these kind of works. The pandemic has been incredibly hard, but I think it has done something to the collective consciousness and to our minds, which make us ready to accept ideas of multiple things being true at once. We seem to be gaining a deeper relationship with the multiverse, hoping our ways into different places, the Zoom meeting that has shrunk the world, our need to imagine those far away, and to also be acutely aware of what it is to be connected and what is lost in our online lives. I think it is right to think of Frame's novels as post-war, and I think this is what makes them ripe for our post-pandemic years, to the world shifting in and out of the one plane. And I think Frame's work is an amazing way to enjoy this newfound consciousness.